Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me this week on Tia Time. We'll get to the show in just a moment. First, I wanted to say thank you to all of you who have posted a rating on Apple Podcast. Apple Podcast is an app that can be downloaded to your phone or computer. The algorithm it uses allows more artists and art enthusiasts like yourselves to hear about the show. So if you haven't posted a rating yet, do it now. Thank you. On with the show. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, the weekly podcast where we discuss the methods, challenges, and real-life experiences of living our creative dreams. What kind of creative warrior are you? Musician, filmmaker, painter, choreographer, poet, sculptor, fashionista? Let's talk about it right now. I'm your host, Tia Imani Hanna. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, and this week my guest is Rick Beeman, who is an amazing drummer and DJ and an actor. So we're going to talk today about how all of that comes together and came together to make this amazing freewheeling spirit that he is. Welcome, Rick.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell me about this. I saw on your website that you talk about that you like to do entertainment. You just to do any kind of entertainment, and explain that to me, because most people, like, they latch on to one thing and that's what they do, but you do many things. And which one of those things drew you first? Was it music that drew you first, or was it acting, or the DJ thing is another aspect of it that's a more technical aspect of it? What drew you first?
I think at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, when you wrap it up and look at the whole picture, in my heart, from my earliest memory that I remember feeling something, was sitting next to my mom's stereo, because she would play records every single day. I was probably 4 years old. I think music was the first thing to get me interested in entertainment, because it was the first thing that grabbed my heart. My earliest memory is seeing an album cover. There was an African-American couple. There was this lady in this long dress, and there was a black guy with this guitar. He had this red guitar. I didn't know what it was when I was looking at it. I found out later on that it was a Fender Stratocaster.
Okay.
But he had this red guitar with this white pickguard. And that's my earliest memory of seeing something that was going to turn my whole life around. And my earliest memory of hearing something was a Johnny Cash record.
Okay. All right.
So music was the thing that got it all started. And music is my passion, is my heart. How I ended up getting into all this entertainment stuff, I guess it culminated over the years. I started out playing drums at age 4 and a half, 5. Shortly after that earliest memory I just shared with you, my brothers were 8 and 11 years older than me. So they were pretty much teenagers by that time. I remember them bringing home a Jimi Hendrix album.
Ah.
And it was the Band of Gypsies. And of course, like I said, I was sitting next to mom's stereo, and they came home in the evening. And mom, can we play this record? She's like, oh, help yourself. So I remember sitting down and I remember hearing this intro. Let's give a really big hand for the Jimi Hendrix Band of Gypsies, right? And I heard this riff. And when I heard Buddy Miles, the drummer, when I heard him come in with pop, 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 bam, I was like, that was it. That was it for me. And so I knew at that point I was going to be a drummer. And that following Christmas, my mom bought me a drum set. Okay. And she said, which I don't remember, she said, I used to go around the house just beating on everything. She said, yeah. Then she had little chips in her furniture from me beating on stuff with spoons and forks and crazy stuff. So the music is my passion, is my heart. It's what kicked off this whole entertainment thing. As I got older, I started wanting to know more about music, not just drums. I wanted to know how guitars work, how amplifiers work. I wanted to know, how is it that I'm seeing all these instruments on stage and I'm hearing them all through this one sound system? That sparked my interest in PA systems and sound engineering and all that kind of stuff. And it just kept growing. The more I learned, the more I wanted to learn. The more I saw, the more I wanted to see.
Most people don't have that kind of curiosity. Usually there's the one thing. You know, that one thing. And then you just want to know everything about that one thing. Because all of my sisters and brothers play instruments. And they played that instrument. But they mm-hmm. would play that instrument. Like, it was like, okay, I'm going to get in there. And how does this thing do that? And that was right. all the curiosity. So when mm-hmm. you see somebody who's doing, how does this piece of it connect to this thing over here that doesn't even seem like it's related, but it is. So you just have a keen interest in things outside of what you're doing immediately in front of you. So you have to have a set kind of mind for that. You know.
Yeah, I agree. Both my parents, my father was, he sang in a gospel group and he messed around with bass. And my mom and all my uncles and aunts on her side, they would just all sit around when they were young and they would just sing and strum on the guitar. So that interest was already there, was always there. My two older brothers play guitar, bass, sax, keyboards. There were so many instruments in my house at one point. So, yeah, it, I don't know. Some people, like you say, they have that one thing that they do. But I was always interested in, okay, if I'm playing drums, okay, and as a drummer, okay, I can't just do a show by myself. So I need a bass player, I need a keyboard player, and maybe a singer or a sax. Now we got a whole band. Well, I always wanted to know, why is what I'm doing so important? It's important because you got to connect with other people. So that's what started opening up my mind. Because mm-hmm. You know, if I just focused on just being a drummer or drums, then that limits me. And as I got older, I didn't want to be limited. I wanted to be as vast and open as I could be. You know?
I think that's very key, because if you're a piano player, you can play by yourself. You might not want to always play by yourself, but you can.
Right.
If you're a drummer, you can play by yourself, but you're not going to go and do a whole concert of drum solos. You know, you're just not. I've seen a whole concert of drum solos before, or solos. I went to see Ayerto one time. He was at a very small venue in New York, Brooklyn Conservatory of Music, which I used to work at. And it's a very small room. It's maybe holds 150 people, maybe. And he was in there and he just had some spoons and he played for an hour. And as great as that concert was, I was like, okay, what else we got? You can only watch it for so long, because it wasn't a room full of percussionists going, oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredible, but it was too much.
Too much of one thing is not good.
Yeah.
You know, everything in moderation. Mm-hmm. Now, you can have a segment where it's just drums, you know, or if you want to have a whole drum show, it's got to be a variety. You got to have not just drums. You got to have a drum set. You got to have like maybe a marching band come in. And then you got to have maybe some percussionists off to the side doing their thing. Then you got to maybe have some xylophones. And,
right.
If it's going to be percussion and drums, it's got to be a variety. But yeah, just to have drums going, that's what sparked my curiosity. Because I'm like, just as a drummer, why is it important? Why is having a drummer important? Well, the drummer's got to drive everything else and keep time and create the dynamics and whatnot.
Well, and it really does shape your ear in a different way. Now, I was just thinking, just from what you were saying, is I play violin and piano and I sing. So all of those things would be considered solo instruments. But when I did play violin and orchestra, I almost always played in the second violin. So I was in the middle of the orchestra, so I could hear more of the other parts and I played more harmony. And I sing, I'm a second soprano and an first alto. So I sing the harmonies that are in the middle so I could hear the other parts. And it really formed my ear to listen in a different way. And when you listen to first violinists and you talk to them, they can hear it too. I'm not saying they can't hear it, but a lot of the time they just hear things differently because they're so attuned to just hearing that first top line.
Right.
They don't listen to the other stuff the same way. They don't see how it's intermeshed. And same thing for like trumpet players and first flute players and stuff like that, because usually they're just playing the melody and they just listen the same way.
That's right.
It makes a huge difference in how you perceive the whole. So I think that's really telling, because one of the things I've noticed in the jazz world is, for whatever reason, trombone players and bass players make great arrangers.
Absolutely.
They're stuck in the middle all the time until they hear all the parts and they hear how all of it intertwines. Their parts just pop in and out in between all of this stuff. So
yeah, Yeah, that's why I always say, whoever's in the drummer's seat, it's important that you, and if you don't already do this as a drummer, then you're missing it, because it's important that every single thing that's going on in the song, it's important that you understand, it's important that you should be able to sing the bass line. Mm-hmm. You should be able to sing the guitar part, or whatever the rhythm guitar part is doing. You should be able to hear the chords. You should be able to hear all of the different notes in the chord, or at least pick out three notes, which makes it a chord. Mm-hmm. You should be able to, as a drummer, you're supposed to know everything, because you're really in the driver's seat. You got to know who's riding your bus. You got to take names. You got to do roll call. You got to know everything that's going on. Mm-hmm. Just like I just played with Bob Jensen's band, Skyline, back in, it was a Saturday. We were up north, and it's four singers, three horns, and rhythm section. Mm-hmm. And you're in the driver's seat. You're really controlling all of that. So you really have to know, you really have to have an ear as a drummer. You have to, I don't know. I would think any drummer would have an interest in a bunch of other things. Because mm-hmm. you're like a spider when you play drums. Literally.
Yeah, and you do, because there's the thing about live music as well is the fact that stuff constantly speeds up, slows down, and not because of you, but because the group will move together. It's kind of, what do they call those, murmurations, when birds and flocks of schools of fish swim in different directions all together. It's music is like that. And if the drummer has to be able to flow with that, because you can't keep it exactly the same, because it's not going to be like that every show. Sometimes the singers are going to be like, whoa, today we're on it. And they're like, even if everybody else is over here, the singers might all be like over here together. And you're like, oh, wait, we got to pull this together. And that's going to be your job, is to connect us together.
That's true. That's true. And if you're playing with different musicians every night, one singer is going to feel Daka the Bay a little bit faster. The singer you played it with last week, she's going to feel it like a really slow ballad. Mm-hmm. So you have to be flexible in that way. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's a real skill. It's a real listening skill. And
true.
And it's one of the things on this show, we try to just give people an idea of what artists think about, what they're going through when they're producing all of this art, because folks just think, oh, it's just like air. It's just there. It's easy to, you enjoy it. It's fun. But there's a whole lot of craft. There's a whole lot of craft involved. And I don't think people see it. So it's nice for us to speak about it.
That's true. That's true. I think the more conversations we have as musicians and artists, it helps the layman to understand what's involved. Because I was having a conversation. I was DJing a wedding a couple of weeks ago. And it was, I think the oldest person there was probably 30. Mm-hmm. And I've been around for a while, not to give away my age, but I've learned a lot and I'm still learning. And when I was coming up, there were human beings playing instruments.
Yes.
And so there was a couple old school songs I played at the wedding. And a couple kids came up. They're like, man, who is that? What is that? And I said, that's from such and such. And they were like, wow. And out of curiosity, I just wanted to see how the young mind works today. And I said, can you pick out the guitar part? And it was three kids. Neither one of them could pick out the guitar part. And it was blatantly obvious. Mm-hmm. But because they're born into a world of so much sound and sequenced and robotic production of music, they can't tell a real guitar from artificial guitar, or they don't know what a guitar sounds like. Mm-hmm. Unless they've been exposed to it and have one or play it themselves. So it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. There's some stuff out there and I really like it because it's inventive, but at the same time I go, my ear keeps going, I want real instruments. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I like what they're doing. I like the way that their compositional minds are working. But sometimes I just go, but that sound is so horrible. It sounds like sometimes they reverse sounds to get a certain effect. And I'm just like, but you could do the same thing with the wah-wah pedal. You know, it's like, you know, and it sounds better, you know, instead of computerized sound, it's a human sound and they don't hear that difference.
Thanks to people like Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak. Yeah. Some of the other artists, they're actually playing instruments and they're actually bringing the sound of actual people playing instruments back. They're bringing it back. And I can appreciate that.
Yeah, it's nice to see that. Because, yeah, sometimes you just go, ooh, because what's that kid's name? I think he's fabulous. I've purchased his albums. He's a British kid. He's in his 20s. Jacob Collier.
Oh, yeah.
And he can do things that I've never seen anybody do. It's amazing. But sometimes the way he does things with the computer, it still pulls my ear in an odd way. Now, and it's, I like the compositional elements, but sometimes the sound is just...
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little grating because it's too much of the computer stuff.
Yeah, if you're born, if you were born like 1995 and beyond, and after that, you were born into a lot of sound. You weren't born into instruments, so to speak. You weren't born into a world that produces music with instruments. You're born in a world that produces instruments based on sound. And a lot of music nowadays, you don't have a bass line. You don't have a guitar part. Just heavy programmed drums and sounds, you know. And I don't call a lot of today's music, I don't call it music. I call it sound. Yeah. It's just a lot of sound. It's not so much music, it's sound. Music has elements of melody and has elements of groove and dynamics and time and feel. So that's what music is to me. So when they say, hey, man, have you ever heard this tune called blah, 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 blah? And I just jokingly say, oh, that's not a tune. That's just the sound that someone's singing on. And they go, what are you talking about? Never mind.
Yeah, no, I agree. Agreed, because there's been times even I like Mary J. Blige, but I remember when she did a cover of I Will Survive. And I remember hearing it on the radio and I didn't recognize the tune because she never sang the melody, not once. Not once. If you listen to it, she never sings the melody. And I reckon the only reason I recognized the song was I recognized the lyric. And I'm like, wait a minute, she's singing I Will Survive. I said, where's the melody? She's singing, it was like she sang a harmony to the melody without the melody playing.
Oh, wow.
Through the whole song.
Wow. So that takes
me back, that's already 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Yeah, that's and interesting. It was.
And I was like, what is this? It was like, whoa.
Wow. That's pretty, now I have to go and listen to it.
And I was, because I didn't recognize the song. And I said, why do I know the lyrics to this? I said, I know the lyrics to this song. What song is this? Because I had to think about it. I'm like, I'm singing these lyrics and I know these lyrics. What song is it? Because I could never hear the melody, not once. And I finally said, oh my gosh, that's I Will Survive. But it was her. And it was like, okay, how do you do a remake of a song without the melody?
Yeah, yeah.
So
I don't know.
That was starting then. So now we're like beyond that. So like you said, it's sound design now as opposed to, but I mean, I have to give Jacob credit because he does use melody and he can write whole orchestral things that are absolutely gorgeous and beautiful songs he's written.
Yeah, very talented young guy.
Yeah. And even some of the stuff he does that's like just sound design is still melodic and still has harmonic stuff. And he's doing stuff that nobody's doing. He's going deep into the scales. And so I'm like, okay, I can hear all that. It's just that every now and then there's like a too much synthesized sound for me. That's all.
Yeah. I can appreciate that about Kendrick Lamar. He produces a lot of the today's sound, but there is melody. There is a progression. And that's, I can listen to that. I can stomach. You
know? Yeah. And that's the other piece is when I listen to the newer stuff, I just go, please don't just make it all modal, two chords.
Yeah.
There are many rock legend songs that are three chords, but they still have a story. They have harmony. They have melody. They have a bridge.
Yeah.
It goes from one thing to another thing and comes back. It has a chorus and a pre-chorus. It makes sense. There's a structure. The stuff now is just, it just stays in one place and never changes. And it's more like, nah, 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 nah. It's like that. And I just go, come on, people.
Right. Yeah. Conversations like this are really healthy. I think the more we bring younger people into what music really is and what it's about and how it's supposed to make you feel. If the more they hear it, like they may not want to hear it right away because their minds are set differently from ours, but the more they hear it, the more they realize that they are a human being and they do have feeling and they do have emotion. Mm-hmm. Then they want to hear it more. They want to hear it again. Because I've had young cats come up to me later on after asking me, what was that you were playing? I've had them come up to me later on, weeks later, months later, years later. Man, you know what? I'm still listening to Curtis Mayfield because a long time ago you told me blah, blah, blah. And I don't even remember the conversation. But I'm like, right. Well, that's good. That's good. You're listening.
It makes all the difference because the thing I'm noticing is I am very grateful for technology going to the where it's gone. Because when I was able to, for the first time, to start carrying my entire, I had 500 CDs or something like that, and I could put it all in one place on my little iPod. I was in heaven. I was like, "It's right, my whole library is right here," and now it's streaming. It's the same thing, but I'm in, and I couldn't do this podcast without this. I'm so grateful for so many things that are directly at hand. Yeah, but I'm always amazed that there's a lot of kids that just like, I will only take what people spoon feed me. They won't look outside. And as you do have people who are older around you, and there is, when famous people die and they say Aretha Franklin, you've never heard of Aretha Franklin stuff. And I'm like, how can you say music if you've never heard Aretha Franklin stuff? They're like, this kid's like, well, who is that? And everybody's like, it's Aretha Franklin. She died. Well, whatever. And they don't know who she is. And instead of saying, oh, maybe I should go investigate who Aretha Franklin is. Maybe I can go online and stream it for, it's there for free. Go look, go on YouTube and say, what does she sound like? That didn't happen for a lot of people. They just said, oh, I don't know who that is, whatever, it doesn't matter. Right. And I'm like, okay, wait, there's a problem there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I always tell them, I always say, hey, go look up such and such. Mm-hmm. You know, young drummers come up to me, hey, man, your pocket is so strong, man. Like, how'd you develop your pocket? Get your phone, take some notes. Okay, go look at, check out Clyde Stubblefield. Check out Harvey Mason. Check out Dave Garibaldi. And I make a list. I say, go listen to all these guys. You'll see why I play like I play with that strong pocket. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we have to educate them. We have to.
We do. Because
we can't let music die. We can't become robots and computers. We can use robots and computers to help us do things. Like you said, being grateful for technology is awesome, but don't lose the human element.
Well,
you're still a human being.
Exactly. I just watched last night, Rick Rubin and Paul McCartney were talking about all Paul McCartney's work with the Beatles and stuff, and they were listening to old tracks, and he was talking about what happened in the studio. I said, that's the coolest stuff ever.
Yep.
That's the coolest stuff ever. And it's like, and the stuff he was telling about one story, and he was talking about how they had particular sounds that they could only do because it would go just across the red line. They had a little meter that would go into the red. And then all the producers were, the studio techs were told not to go over the red. They said, yes, go over the red because it gives us this distortion effect. At that time, that was the only way they could do it. And so he says now they can't do that because the gear is too good. So it's fine. It just takes it. But back then they got special sounds from that.
Yes.
And it's like all these things happened accidentally and it's like landmark stuff.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool to hear that story.
You go to studio and some of the studios that still have some of the old mixing boards from the 60s and 70s and some of the 80s. And you look at that panel and you see what do you call them? The meters.
Yeah, the meters.
And it's letting you know, it's like, it's all green right here. Mm-hmm. Then right here is a little bit of a yellow. Then it hits red. Uh-oh, you're dangerous now, you know. But now you've got so much electronic or digital compression and digital gates now where, you know, some stuff you put in, it will automatically compress it for you.
Yes.
So you can't hit that.
You can't do it. You can't do it. Right. Yeah, because they played a thing, I think it was Eleanor Rigby. Mm. They had the flutes at the end of it were playing. And at the very end of the song, because they turned down everything else so you could hear it, because of the resonance of the flutes, it vibrated the cymbal on the drums. And then you got an After Effect overtone ring on the cymbal that was slightly flat, that rang all the way to the end. It was over, it was a feedback. Mm-hmm. But it was about almost, I would say, a quarter of a tone flat.
Mm.
But it was there, and it just rang all the way through it. But it was cool. And they got that because they had the old school meters that couldn't do anything about that. And they kept it.
Wow.
And so that, at the end of the song, you've got that thing. You can't hear it individually because they have other layers on top of it. But it's there, so you're picking that up, and you don't realize you're picking it up.
Right.
But it's there.
That's the beauty of stuff. The temptation is get ready.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a minute, listen to that tune. And I think about the second or third verse, there's like a low mid-range like hum. Almost sounds like a low mid-range feedback that's going on throughout. It's like from there to almost to the end of the song. And I'd never noticed it one day. I was listening to it in the headphones because I was mixing it. I was listening to it and I was like, wait a minute, what is that? I started trying to channel it out. I'm like, that's in the recording.
Yeah. It's there.
But it gives it some kind of character. Because in normal situations, you would hear it and you would get rid of it. You'd find that frequency and you channel it out. Yeah. But man, it's there. It's there. It freaked me out when I heard it.
it's that extra bit of humanity because it's probably somebody's amp.
Right.
It's probably an amp hum. But it's there in the room.
Yeah, and when they were, and the engineer was like, you know what? It's done. I can't fix it. The performance on this was so great. Let's just press it. Print it. Let's do it. You know,
or they didn't notice it. You never know.
Or they didn't notice it. Yeah. Because equipment was way different back then.
It just adds, because if you were in a club, you'd hear it. And you would just say, that's just part of that sound. You wouldn't even realize it was like, unless it was like really obvious, you wouldn't notice it.
Right. But,
and it just, that band sounds like that because that bass player has that amp that always hums. They got a different amp. Y'all don't sound the same. What happened?
Exactly. And it's good. It's good to discover these things and realize that they're there because some songs that we've been listening to for years sound the way they sound and feel the way they sound because of X, Y, Z.
Yeah. You know? It's that human element of things that aren't perfect. And the computers will try to make everything perfect. And it's not about that. It's the stuff I record, like lately, I only have two recordings, but they're edgy because I do improvisation mostly. And we just go and we start playing. Mm. So there's edginess and we make it into something. And if it works, we keep it. If it doesn't, we cut it. But so the one album I have is pretty edgy, and I like that because you go into the studio, it's people, recordings are supposed to be a snapshot of musicians at the time doing what they're doing at that moment. It's you're at that concert.
Yeah.
And so to have that energy, you have to have that when you go in the studio. Yes, you're on the line. This is it, which is what you would do at a live concert. And old school jazz recordings, yes, everybody rehearsed and then you went in and you did it, but you still only had 45s back in the day. You only had 3 minutes to cut that song.
That's right.
So you had to get it right. you couldn't be spending a lot of time in the studio. You did if you had a label behind you, but even still, you had maybe 4 or 5 times possibly to get one track done.
Yeah.
In there all week doing it, like not until the late 70s with super mega rock groups did you get to the point where they're like a month in the studio on an album. That just didn't happen.
And there was no cut and pasting or punch me in right here because I hit a wrong note. No, you had to start over from the beginning.
Yeah. So you got it, and then you got used to getting it, and that's where I come from because I studied classical music, and classical music, you do the concert. If it's wrong, it's wrong.
Yeah.
So you better like practice your ass off. Then you go on stage and it's right. And I've listened to a lot of interviews with people like Gladys Knight and the Four Tops and people like that. And they said that's how it was. You practiced and you went to the studio. You were ready. You just did it. And so I was like, okay, that's how you have to do it. And that, I think that spirit is a little bit lost now because they can punch it.
Yeah.
But I think we need to go back to that a little bit because
I agree.
Because your level has to be high no matter what. One of the things I've learned from a lot of different teachers was that, yeah, you're the lead player, but if you can't play the song in your head, everybody else could be lost, but you can't be lost.
That's right.
You have to know where you are in the song because sometimes you have to tell everybody else where you are.
That's right.
And it's happened. It's happened many times.
Yeah. It continues to happen because people get lost for various different reasons. Mm-hmm. You got to know the song. You got to have it in your head. You got to know it. Mm-hmm. You know, same thing with acting. You get on set, you have to know your lines. Mm-hmm. You can't be messing around. You got to know your lines because you're holding everybody up.
Yes. Yeah. Now, how did you get into acting? Like, did you start that when you were younger too?
You know what? Yes and no. When we grew up, we didn't have a whole lot. We were like on the poor side. And my mom, she really worked hard to make our lives happy. So one of the things she did to make our lives happy was watching television. Mm-hmm. We had our shows that we watched. And the more I watched television as a kid, the more I wanted to do what I saw the actors doing. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I always said, I want to do that. I want to be on set. I want to run those lines. I didn't say I want to be famous. I want to be rich. I said, I want to act. And that went away. It was something from my childhood. It went away. I didn't think about it again until I was almost 30. Okay. And then I was working for Disney Cruise Line. And as a musician, one cruise, there was this couple that they came all 7 nights of this cruise. They would be the first people there and the last people to leave. Okay. They just loved the band for some reason. And they both got up and danced to every single song. So they asked the assistant cruise director, can we buy every band member, every person in the band, can we buy them a nice bottle of wine? Mm-hmm. And she was like, yeah, sure. We all got a bottle of wine. They wanted to hang out with us, kick it with us. Long story short, I'm sitting there talking with the couple, with the rest of the band. And the guy is looking at me and he's looking at me with this weird look on his face. And I'm like, they've been partying, they've been drinking. So he's probably a little tipsy or whatever.
Yeah.
Then he nudges his wife and he points at me and she looks at me and she nods her head, giving him the approval. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know what's going on in guy's head right now. But, so I asked him, I said, what's up, man? I said, you're looking at me like, what's going on? He goes, you know what? You got a face for cameras. You got a face for acting. He said, you should actually get into it. I said, it's funny. I used to want to be an actor when I was a kid. And I said, it just went away. And music took over and music was the thing. Mm-hmm. And he was like, here, man, take my card. He says, when do you sign off the ship? I said, I got a couple months left on my contract. He goes, when you sign off the ship, call me, man. He says, I want to put you in touch with some people. Where are you from? I said, I'm from Detroit, Michigan. He says, okay, I got some people in Michigan. When you sign off, call me. I forgot about it. It was 2 months later. I got home. I was home for a month. And I happened to be clearing out some of my stuff from the ship. You're on the ship for a few months. You got pretty much your life with you. So I'm going through stuff. I come across this guy's card. And I'm like, oh, man. He told me to call him. So I called. And he had to remember who I was because he and his wife travel a lot. And they go on trips and take cruises. He goes, oh, yeah, you're the drummer. You're the drummer with that face. I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, so he says, hey, man, call this guy. And I want you to call this guy and have him do your headshot. And I was like, oh, okay. So I called the guy to get a headshot done. And I called those people that he told me to call. And they were like, yeah, do this, do that, blah, blah, blah. I did everything that they said do. And I ended up registering with these 8 talent agencies. Mm-hmm. The very first day I went into an agency with my headshot. I was just going in there to register, but there was an audition happening.
Okay.
When I walked in, I'm like, let me just get out of the way because I don't want to interrupt what's going on. So I go over to the desk and I say to the young lady, I say, hey, I'd like to register with your agency. And I have my headshot and my resume or whatever. And she goes, put your name on that list right there and have a seat. I say, okay, cool. I put my name on the list. I had a seat. So about 30 people went in. I'm just sitting there, just waiting. So everybody left, and I'm the last guy. And so the people in the audition room comes out, and they're like, come on in. I'm like, what? you're the last one. I said, no, I'm just here to register with the agency. I wasn't a part of the audition. He says, is your name Rick Beeman? I said, yeah. He says, come in. I said, all right. So I went in and I'm auditioning for a Ford commercial. I didn't know what I'm like. And he goes, what I need you to do, there's going to be an imaginary truck that falls out of the sky. I need you to just react to it.
Okay.
I was like, oh, okay. So he goes, slate your name, height, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to pop my finger. When I pop my finger, that's when the truck hits the ground. I want you to react. I'm like, okay. Pop this finger and I reacted like I was looking at a truck. And I just had fun with it. And I was like walking around and I was like examining the truck or whatever. And they were like, all right, thanks. Thank you. So I went home. After when I left the audition, I filled out the form and everything, got registered, and I went home. I'm out there cutting my grass. Come in the house and missed the call. Look at my phone. It's the agency. And I pick up, I'm listening to the message, and they're like, yeah, Mr. Beeman, we want you to, you loved your audition. They want you to, you got the part. And I'm like, what? I wasn't even there to audition. I didn't even know an audition was going on. I just wanted to walk in and register. Because sure. I had followed what all these people said, dude. And I ended up getting that gig, and it was a national spot. I got royalties off of it for a year.
Oh, great.
And then the agency would have been calling me, and then I would go in and audition. Some of the jobs I get, some I wouldn't. And that was, oh, I don't know, probably 2003 or four.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's how it happened. That's how I got to do it. I always wanted to do it as a child, but I never really tried to follow through with it. And then it found me, I guess.
That's awesome.
Right.
How did you were getting these parts, but did you like go and take some acting classes in the meantime? Or how did you like practice some of these skills?
The funny thing is I contacted a few people that the guy, the gentleman and his wife, and I'm sorry that their names escaped me because that was a long time ago. But I was calling people that they were telling me to call. One of the guys that I called was acting coach. And I had a couple sessions with him. He didn't even charge me. He just gave me some pointers. He was like, if you got to play this kind of role, do this. He said, do these exercises. He just gave me a bunch of stuff to practice. And I'm like, all right, cool, cool. And now I'm like, do you have a school? Do you have classes? He goes, I take private students here and there, but I don't really teach anymore. And he says, I don't really want to take your money. He said, but I guarantee you, he said, if you do these things and just practice them, when you go on for your auditions, these things will help you get some jobs. So that's about it. You know?
Okay.
So
sure.
I guess indirectly, I took some acting classes or tips, mm-hmm. you know, but the rest was just me using my imagination as an entertainer, because when we're on stage as musicians, we're acting, we got to put that face on. We have to perform,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's gotta be real. You have to feel what you're doing. If you're playing a role, if you're playing a psychopath, you need to, you know, really think, what is it like to be a psychopath? I'm not a psychopath, so I don't know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to study, you got to research, you even got to read old news clippings from the library about murders and things that happened and try to get into this mindset, which is actually scary. Whatever the role is you're playing, it's got to be real. It's got to be real to you.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're acting, you're playing this role. Someone said to me, a person that a local actor said to me that I really admire. She actually lives in L.A. now. I asked her, because I looked up to her, I said, you're such a good actor. How do you do that? How do you become that person? She said, Rick, I don't become the character. The character becomes me. And I said, whoa. She says, I'm real. Fictional. I'm real. She says, so that character has to wear me. That character has to wear my skin and bones. And I'm like, wow, okay. And it took me a while to really wrap my head around that. But the more you are yourself, the more you are the character at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's like I would be a horrible actor.
So you say.
The reason I say that is because I've worked so very hard in developing my craft of speaking my voice through my music. Like my voice. So it would be really, like, it's really hard for me now to not just be myself 100%. So to be somebody else is really difficult.
It makes sense. If they give you this character and they say, you're Cassandra Morgan, and you're an arrogant woman but you get the job done. At the end of the day, you get the job done, but you're so arrogant. People don't like working with you. Mm-hmm. That's probably nothing like your personality. Mm-hmm. So the funny thing about that is you got to think about somebody that's like that.
That's true.
And you basically portray them. I guess there's so many different ways of a character. Another actor friend of mine, also in LA, she got a role playing a really pissed off girlfriend.
Okay.
And I asked her, I said, how did you pull it off? Because I saw some of the clips of the work and I was like, whoa. I said, how did you pull that off? She said, Rick, I just never broke character. She said, me, I'm hardly ever angry. I'm like, that's why I'm like shocked. She goes, I just never broke character. And she said, I went up to the actor, that the guy that I was supposed to be mad at. She said, and I said to him, she said, hey, I'm not going to break character. So when we break to go to lunch, if you see me stare at you and just gritting my teeth, she said, don't take it personal. And he was like, oh, okay, no problem. That's actually cool. So during lunch, she was looking at him and she was just like gritting her teeth. And every time he looked up at her, he said he got a little freaked out. And she said, when they got on set and the director said action, and she kicked the door in and she started delivering her lines, she was already angry at him. Because mm-hmm. she'd been angry from the time she saw him that morning all the way through. And when she walked out, she smacked him. And she went outside and she was breathing heavy. And she was like, oh, my God, I'm going to get fired because I smacked him. So she stayed outside and she was like, oh, God, why did I do that? So the director came outside. And he goes, are you OK? She says, yeah, I'm fine. She said, I did not mean to hit him. And she goes, if I'm fired from a, he goes, that was great. And she was like, she said, can I please go in and apologize to the actor? He is so excited. He was shocked that you hit him, of course, but he's so excited. Like, we're printing that take right there. And she went back in and she was apologizing. She said, I'm so sorry I hit you. I didn't know. I just lost it. And he was like, yeah, you did. But he said, it doesn't get any better than that.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes you can get fired if you hit the star, or you're not supposed to. Because sometimes they have the budget to bring in stunt people. Sometimes the actor has to do it his or herself. Mm-hmm. And you got to be careful. I was on set once with the Mark Strong. I don't know if he is, but he's been in a lot of different films. He was in a series that was filmed here in Michigan called The Low Winter Sun. He's been in the Kingsman series 1 and 2.
Oh, yeah.
He played Blackbeard or something like Black something in Sherlock Holmes. He played a villain. Mm-hmm. He was in Green Lantern. He's named for himself. Anyway, I had to dialogue with him and we get into a fight. And I'm supposed to give him a right cross. So we're rehearsing this with the stunt people. We rehearsed it like 30 times. And my shoulder was so sore from throwing the right cross. So, you know, the stunt coordinators, the head stunt coordinator, he taught us how to swing and get close without hitting the person. Mm-hmm. So I had it down. After doing it 30 times, I had it down. So we bring in Mark Strong to actually do a take now, takes rather. And we run it a few times. And I guess Mark had went over to the assistant director. And the assistant director walked over to me. He goes, man, you got to be careful. You can't hit the star. You'll get fired. I said, bro, I'm pretty sure I'm not hitting them. I'm like, I rehearsed it tons of times. And I'm like, I'm like 100% sure I'm not connected. So the cool thing about Mark Strong is after we did it one more time, Mark walked over to me. He says, let me see your sleeve. And the costume they had me in, my sleeves were rolled up. I was supposed to be a construction guy. They have those little pins that you snap to keep the sleeve up. Mm-hmm. It was loose hanging. And that was nicking him. Every time I went to swing, that little thing was nicking him. And he didn't go to the director and say, your guy is hitting. He went to the assistant director and said, I don't know what's going on, blah, 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 blah. So he did it in such a way where I wouldn't get fired.
Okay.
He didn't go to the director and say, hey, man, that guy's hitting me. Mm-hmm. He was so cool about it. And he actually stopped to think, okay, I know he's not hitting me. And when he asked to see my sleeve and saw what it was, it all worked out. But isn't it interesting how little things like that I was nervous. I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure I'm not hitting him, but oh God, I don't want to get fired from this. Because I'd like to have it on my resume. I worked with Mark Strong, socked him in the chin. But man, I'm telling you, it was scary. It was real scary because I thought I was going to get fired from that.
Oh my gosh. But what a cool person that he at least tried to figure it out, because he knew what kind of position. He's been there before himself, I'm sure. So he said, the guy's not, if you were hitting him, he'd know.
Right. You know? Right. He knew something was touching him. But he knew I was, he couldn't figure it out. And I couldn't figure it out either, because I had just did this 30 times. And the head stunt coordinator was like, man, he said, man, you caught on to this really fast. Mm-hmm. I said, I used to fight a lot when I was a kid. So.
Oh, man. So where can people find you for films? What films should we look for you for?
I haven't done anything like super, super sweet or crazy or whatever, but I'm happy to say that I have done some things. I've, you know, worked with Mark Strong. I've worked with Michael Imperioli he was with in The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. He was the lead in a show called Detroit 187.
Okay.
I got in on that on the season finale. I think it's called Motor City Blues. And I play this character called Mel. And I'm just a character in the holding cell. I had my one line delivering.
Okay.
That's out there. Detroit 187, Motor City Blues is the season finale. The series with Mark Strong was Low Winter Sun. That was also a season finale, and it was the episode called Ann Arbor. Okay. In an Amazon series called I Declare War, I think it's 8 to 10 episodes or something like that. I'm in the second episode, and I play a character named Brandon Williams, and I'm confronting my son. It's a very intense scene. Very intense, like one of those scenes where when you're done delivering the lines, the whole set is quiet. You hear a pin drop.
Yeah,
I've been in. I've done a music video with Eminem, Toy Soldiers. No lines or anything, just making appearances, like a newscaster in the hospital room. I've done some things. Done a handful of commercials. But like I said, nothing super major, crazy, or anything like that. Detroit's not really an active town, but we did have a nice run when our ex-governor Jennifer Granholm was in. She gave Hollywood a 40% tax break. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things came here. But then all that went away. Parts of me really feel strong about moving west, but I'm not really 100% sure. But I know if I want to continue acting, I have to go either to L.A. or Atlanta. Or, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I'm gonna.
Well, and as far as recordings and stuff, now where can we find you for that? Where can we hear you?
Oh man, I've recorded with so many artists in town. Gosh, I can't even think of. I don't know. I've recorded with Paul Randolph. Recorded with. Oh gosh, let's see who else. Oh, man, Kimmy Horn. Let's see who else have I recorded with. Probably more. It's probably more recognizable. My live performances and tours, mm-hmm. names people recognize. Like when I was 25, I went on a tour with the Dramatics,
okay.
which they're from Detroit. Mm-hmm. When I was about 27, I toured a little bit with the Contours, mm-hmm. also from Detroit. I've done some shows with Sherelle, who's also from Detroit. Mm-hmm. I've done a small tour with Gene Karn, Shirley Jones from the Jones Girls, Allison Williams. And I've done some stuff with local people. I've traveled overseas with Thornetta Davis quite a bit. Mm-hmm. We've gone to Italy and Yugoslavia and Northeast Africa. But yeah, I'm working on my own recording right now. It's been a long time and it's been too long. And it's time for me to really put my voice out there now. So I've been writing since I was 11 years old. I'll come in here in the studio. Long story short, my mom passed away about 3 years ago. I was taking care of her for a while.
Okay.
But it took me about a year to wrap my head around stuff. And then yet last year we experienced the shutdown. So that's when I came in here and I rearranged the studio and I sat down at the keyboard and I started really working on some things from age 11 all the way through. Mm-hmm. And I just started developing and arranging and putting things together. I've got quite a bit of it done. I still got a lot more to go, but this will be my very first Rick Beeman recording project.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And then the DJing, you're doing that all the time too, right?
Yeah, I've got quite a few weddings and corporate gigs that I do. I've done a couple of venues here and there. I do a lot of, anywhere between 6 to 8 weddings a year. Not a lot because I'm so busy with other things. Drumming with a lot of local artists around town. I've just about played with everybody in town.
this Detroit hustle for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many Detroit artists that I gig with on a regular basis. And I have a small entertainment company. It's only been around for like just under 6 years, providing a DJ service, lighting, sound, MC, hosting. Mm-hmm. Pretty much anything you need, I know enough people to pull them in, bring them in for the gig. But yeah, I've got a big DJ production show that I've been working on for over 10 years.
Okay.
And it is going to be mostly original music, electronic, with a nice twist and nice flair to it.
Okay.
Different from what you normally would hear. If I say the word that's in my head, I'll give away too much. But the project is designed around dancers. Mm-hmm. So it's me DJing. It's probably a guy on playing keyboards, probably another guy doing some spontaneous different things on drum machine and things like that. And it's 4 or 6 dancers. Mm-hmm. And this big project I want to promote in Europe. And it's a big deal. I've been working on it for 10 years and it's taken a while. It's financially, it's a big deal, because to actually put it all together for the promo video, that's going to take a lot. It's going to take a lot of camera angles, a lot of staging, a lot of choreography, a lot of sound, a lot of music. Big deal. Mm-hmm. And once it's ready, I want to travel Europe with it. Okay. And I feel 100% that it will be a success. That's how confident I am in it.
Fantastic. Where can people find you online?
I've got a Facebook page. I'm not extremely active on Facebook, which I probably should be more of, but I'm working on so many other things that I just can't talk about within the time that we have. I have a website, which is basically rickyb.org. But I don't really post a lot of stuff there. And I don't post a whole lot on Facebook, but a lot of people that I play with, do shows with, they're always posting. So if you type in Rick Beeman, a bunch of stuff will come up all over the place. Yeah, it's just one of those things where I'm at that point where, after taking care of my mom all these years, I'm at that point where I'm just starting my life, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Never been married, never had any children. I've always been involved in music and acting. So I guess I'm at that point now where this is the beginning of my life and things are starting to take on shape. But it's still very early in life for me at my age.
Well, it's okay. That's okay. You're making your way. You're always moving forward. I totally get that.
Mm-hmm. So
thank you so much for spending time with us and talking about your journey and your visions and just talking and about your curiosity to understand the arts and to understand to search out this craft and these crafts that you have. Keep it up and we'll be out here watching and rooting for you. So thank you for your time today. Thanks for coming to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I greatly appreciate it. It was such an honor to be asked.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website, tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. We really appreciate your comments and will mine them to bring you more amazing episodes.
I would like to thank this inaugural season sponsors, the folks at Jazz Lines of Bend, Michigan, or JAM. Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, is a partner in supporting the Tia Time podcast and Sham Bones Music. Without their support, this podcast would not be possible. Thank you so much. If you would also like to contribute to the show, you can find us on patreon.com.
If you want to continue the conversation about topics discussed on the show or start new ones with like-minded people, join us at the Tia Time Lounge on Facebook. Thank you for listening. See you next week at Tia Time.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website at tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts to expand the reach of the show. We really appreciate that help. And we'd also like to say thank you so very much to our sponsors, Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, and Cold Plunge Records. And also all of our Patreon supporters. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. We'll see you next week at Tea Time.